Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to the programme. Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half. And a fascinating show I've got for you today. This is the programme where Christians and non-Christians get together to debate and talk. And today we're going to be looking at the origin of life. More on that in just a moment's time. If you're interested, though, in how to engage with non-Christians, perhaps you're a Christian who wants help with answering some of the tough questions that sometimes get thrown your way, then why not come along to Unbelievable, the Conference 2013, happening on Saturday the 25th of May. I'm going to be hosting the conference. We've got a range of brilliant speakers there, including Alistair McGrath, Amy Orr Ewing, Peter S. Williams, who was on the show recently. And we've got a load of different topics, seminars that you can choose from during the day to take part in, to listen, to ask questions, and so on. It really is a fantastic day. The third time we've run this conference, and everyone who's come before has said how much they've appreciated it, how much it's helped them. Well, this year we're doing it in partnership with Reasons to Believe, Real Clear Apologetics, and RE Today Services. And if you'd like to book a ticket, or indeed a couple of tickets, because there's a special incentive if you book two or more tickets, you'll get last year's conference on DVD for free. Well, why not go along to the website where you can do that? That's premier.org.uk/Jesus. Once more, the website to book your tickets, to find out more, premier.org.uk/Jesus. Really looking forward to having with us as well at the conference Fuzz Rana, who's from Reasons to Believe, one of our conference partners this year. And he's in today's show. So let's find out what we're talking about with him and our other guest, Adam Rutherford.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today's discussion is all about the origin of life. How did life begin, we're asking today? Was it down to design in some way, or the blind forces of nature? Can we go to those for an explanation of how the first living organism came into being? Well, I've got two very interesting guests joining me for today's programme. One of them is Adam Rutherford, whose new book, Creation, The Origin of Life, and indeed its co-book, Creation, The Future of Life, came out just this last week. So it's great to have Adam on the show. You may remember he joined me a few years ago for a bit of a bruising encounter with his brother, Peter Hitchens.
Peter Hitchens, yes.
not the Hitch, but the other Hitch. It's great to have you back. Thank you, Adam.
Nice to be here.
For coming in. Glad you dared to enter these studios again after that encounter.
It was somewhat brutalising, that interview with Peter Hitchens, but I learned from it.
We all do, always do, don't we? And we're going to be looking at your two books, actually, today. My other guest is Fuzz Rana, who may be familiar as a name from Reasons to Believe. They're involved with this year's Unbelievable Conference, and Fuzz is going to be speaking in one or two of the seminars this year on Saturday, the 25th of May. Fuzz, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're going to get into the discussion today. It's an area that both of you gentlemen have looked at in some depth. Let's start with you, though, Adam. You are not only an author, you're a broadcaster. Your series on The Cell was out on the BBC a couple of years ago now. An editor of Nature magazine as well. So you've been doing this stuff for a long time. What made you want to write a book particularly on the origin of life?
Well, it felt like that the time was right. And so in terms of being a scientist, I studied evolutionary biology as an undergraduate, and then I went on to do a PhD in genetics, medical genetics, really. And after that, I became a journalist, and I've been doing that for about 10 years. And over the course of the last 10 years, I've seen both the fields of evolution and molecular biology, genetics, really expand. And it felt like that this was the right time that you could begin to answer these two questions that I'm trying to address in the two halves of the book. The first is how life began in the first place, so before the origin of species, before evolution. And the second question of what we can do with our newfound knowledge of how life works, how we can engineer and design intelligently organisms in order to serve our own purposes, engineering-wise.
It's a very smart book as well, because it's one of those ones you flip over and you've got another book on the other side, so sort of upside down.
Yes, this was my editor's brilliant idea. When it became apparent that these were two very intricately related fields, but distinct. So one is about the epicness of life on Earth, and the other is about our own human agency. And so he had the idea of splitting the two books in half, but joining them in the middle in the index. And so you can read, I hope, in either direction, and you can read them independently as well.
So doesn't quite work on the Kindle edition, I'm
assuming. It doesn't. You can't turn the Kindle upside down. And Fuzz has a copy of the book, but I'm afraid the American version is not flipped in that direction.
It's just a standard.
Just an old-fashioned book.
But it is nonetheless, it's fascinating stuff. And in a way, this has been a perennial question at the forefront of chemistry and biology. How did life begin? And many people, and I think Fuzz is going to be making that case today, have said, particularly perhaps those who are coming from a religious background, the building blocks of life are so complicated, do seem to require such a degree of precision and engineering that it looks designed. Now, are you saying in this book that you believe you've found a good explanation for how life could have arisen, the first DNA molecule and so forth, without any need for any kind of guiding agency at work?
Yes, a guiding agency is not necessary nor sufficient for any model of the origin of life if one is looking at it from a scientific point of view, because it really raises more questions than answers. The number of different ideas, scientific models for the origin of life that I try to address in this book are all based on evidence, the evidence that we see around us, but also experimental evidence from molecular biology in the lab, which has really blossomed in the last decade or so. There has been a scientific attempt to understand the origin of life since before Darwin, in fact, and it was Darwin himself who first began to speculate about the idea that we now know as a primordial soup. He wrote a letter to his friend Joseph Hooker in 1871, where he talked about a warm little pond, maybe invigorated by electricity, by lightning, and that's the prevailing idea in the origin of life as a science. I also think, and I argue in the book, that it's not correct. And in fact, it fails to address one of the basic laws of physics, the second law of thermodynamics. And so a different and a newer model that has emerged, which is the one that I'm supporting, which is that life emerged at the bottom of the ocean in a particular type of submarine hydrothermal vent. So these they're called white smokers, where there's a rip in the ocean floor and various gases and bubbles percolate through rock and create a particular type of rock called serpentinized rock. And it is there that you see the basic, most underlying facet of biology, which actually I also argue predates DNA and RNA. So in fact, it is my understanding, it's my belief that the origin of life was not informational in its starting point. It wasn't based on DNA, but was based on what we might now refer to as metabolism.
So the complexity that we see in the modern cell can be essentially reduced to something that happened pre that complexity. And for you, there's good evidence that it happened in these underwater hot chambers, if you like.
Yeah.
And probably we don't have time to go into the exact science work. But give us just an idea of how that would have started to sort out those fundamental proteins and whatever that were needed to start to arrange in a way that could eventually produce a living molecule.
Sure. Well, you know, complexity, as one of the scientists that I quote in the book, is in the eye of the beholder. And so when we find things complex, that doesn't necessarily mean that the universe does. So, for example, and I think this is a very culturally embedded idea. When I look at a chemistry textbook and look at one of the molecules that is involved that is absolutely inherent to all life forms, such as an amino acid or one of the letters of DNA, I look at it and, you know, it's horrifying. I did biochemistry as an undergraduate and don't wish to relive those days or those molecular pathways again, as most biochemists don't, I should think. But of course, we know that just because we can't synthesize something in a lab, or just because it looks difficult on paper, that doesn't mean that it's difficult to, that it doesn't mean that the universe finds it difficult to create. So, for example, an example we give is, I give in the book, is that one of the letters of RNA, which is DNA's cousin, is called uracil. Now, for many years, it's been a big problem in biochemistry for many years, our failure to synthesize uracil in the way that nature finds it very easy to do. And yet, in the space of 1 year, about 2009-2010, we determined that uracil was present in meteorites, that the universe can create it in rocks from space that land on Earth, and that uracil is of extraterrestrial origin. And also, what's known as synthetic chemistry, a paper in the journal I work for by a group called, led by a guy called John Sutherland, they found a way of synthesizing uracil in what they refer to as prebiotically plausible conditions, i.e. the conditions of what we think the early Earth might have been like. And so even though that we found the synthesis of something such as uracil, which is essential for all living things, we found it very difficult. But
it occurs.
It does occur.
And suggests that this process, however it occurs, happens in the universe naturally. It's not exclusive somehow to this planet and so on.
That's right. So we see almost all of the facets of basic biology that are universally shared on the entire tree of life. We see individual elements of those occurring in nature without the hand of agency, without the hand of design.
Well, let's bring in Fuzz at this point, Fazal Rana, to give him his proper name. But Fuzz is a speaker, an author, a broadcaster himself with Reasons to Believe out in the States. He's also the author of Creating Life in the Lab, which we're going to be kind of turning our focus to in the next programme. But today, really, Fuzz, talking about the origin of life. Now, you're a biochemist yourself by background, and you haven't had a chance, unfortunately, just because of the way things have worked out, to have a kind of thorough read of the book by Adam, but you're well aware of the area and what's involved. And what's your kind of general take on this? Is Adam onto something? Are we in a position to start looking at a kind of naturalistic explanation for where those incredibly complex life forms, you know, those first DNA molecules came from?
Yeah, well, you know, Adam did a good job, I think, of summarizing very briefly the history of research in the origin of life. And it's true, it predates Darwin's time, interest in how does life originate. And probably the discipline really began as a formal scientific discipline in the 1920s with the Oparin-Haldane hypothesis. Oparin, a Russian biochemist, J.B.S. Haldane, a British geneticist, independently suggested models for how simple chemical systems could essentially evolve over time into entities that we would begin to recognize as cellular forms. And that model, or those that combined collection of models from both gentlemen, their subtle differences in their approaches, was experimentally tested for the first time in the 1950s with the famous Miller-Urey experiment done at the University of Chicago by Stanley Miller. And from that time, there's been, again, a strong interest in trying to explain the origin of life through some form of chemical evolution. And the discipline today is an incredibly rich discipline from a scientific perspective. There's an unbelievable collection of models and ideas out there trying to, again, explore or probe how life originates. metabolism first models like Adam mentioned, or replicator first ideas. I'm a membrane and lipid biochemist by training, so there's even a lipid world model for how life might have originated as well. And of course, where do the prebiotic materials come from? A wide range of ideas and models that have been proposed. So it's an extremely rich discipline where there's been a lot of work and some rather remarkable work in recent times. But one of the things that I note in not only Creating Life in the Lab, but also in another book called Origins of Life that I co-authored with an astronomer, Hugh Ross, is that all of these different models at some point in the process of evaluating them, they fail. They end up hitting dead ends. And so while there's been a lot of activity in Origin of Life research, some very clever ideas, some exceptional work, I greatly admire researchers that are involved in this enterprise from a scientific perspective. I believe every approach has essentially reached some form of a dead end. And what I do in Creating Life in the Lab is actually point out that when it comes to trying to validate different steps in the process of chemical evolution, there really are three goals when a scientist goes into a laboratory and does an experiment. One is to determine whether or not the chemistry or the physics is even possible. It's a proof of principle type of experiment. Another set of goals in those types of studies would be to understand mechanistically if a particular chemical process or physical process is proven to be plausible, what is the mechanism that undergirds it? And then the third step is to demonstrate geochemical plausibility. That is, that those processes would happen in a productive manner towards the origin of life under the conditions of the early Earth or some other location in our solar system or beyond. And this is where I believe the origin of life program from a chemical evolutionary perspective fails. It's very clear from a proof of principle standpoint that most of the chemistry and physics needed to account for different steps in the origin of life is indeed plausible. Wonderful work understanding the mechanisms, but when it comes to, again, translating that chemistry from a lab into the conditions of, let's say, the early Earth, that's where we see things begin to break down. And so in both Origins of Life and in Creating Life in the Lab, I basically document problems with that translation from, again, laboratory plausibility to geochemical plausibility.
Okay. Well, that's a really good place to start. And I'll just announce now, if you're listening and you particularly want to get in touch with anything you hear on the program today, do drop us an email. We'd be interested to hear your views. Perhaps you've got a background in science yourself and have something to say on the issue of the origin of life. I'd be delighted to hear from you if you email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget, you can get in touch, of course, via our Facebook page, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. I know a few people were looking forward to today's program when I mentioned it earlier on in the week. You can also find us on Twitter @unbelievablejb. So look forward to hearing from you in those different ways. You're listening to Unbelievable. Today we're asking, how did life begin? Was it design? Or was it the blind forces of nature? Looking at a book by Adam Rutherford, Creation, The Origin of Life. And my guest from the States today, Fuzz Rana of Reasons to Believe.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, Adam, so we heard Fuzz's sort of analysis of the whole area. Do you take a more optimistic view of the explanations that are being proffered for how life began? Fuzz talking about a lot of dead ends, including the one that you lay out in the book, the metabolism view of how origins might have been started.
Fuzz is absolutely right, and that there is systematic failure in all of the processes of research in science, and that, of course, is how we make progress in science. You asked me if I'm more optimistic about it. Well, the answer is yes, because I see those dead ends and those failures as part of the process in which we continue to research and find out what might have been the actual, the plausible mechanisms for all of these things that have so far resulted in dead ends. I guess the fundamental difference between us, and Fuzz is a biochemist, so he understands biochemistry probably better than I do, but I don't see those dead ends as being the source of any external or divine intervention or the agency of something that is scientifically supernatural. If that's not a
contradiction in terms of it.
This
brings us to the nub of the issue, which is that for you, presumably, Adam, a design hypothesis, which I think is probably where Fuzz is heading as he talks about dead ends, is that simply a hypothesis that is off the table? Because the nature of science is that you have to look for these sort of naturalistic methods of understanding where things came from, how things work.
Well, yes, if it's not testable, it's not science. And if there is an agency that doesn't fit into our current understanding of how the natural world works, then it isn't testable, it's not experimentable, and therefore it can't be part of the scientific discourse. But the other answer to that is that I see no reason for that interjection. What we don't know now, or those dead ends that Fuzz quite rightly refers to in all of the different aspects of the biochemistry and the genetics and indeed the membrane formation, any of the geochemistry of the early Earth, all of those dead ends are ones that we will at some point either work around or unblock, because that's how science progresses.
It's had dead ends in the past, which we managed to overcome.
Of course, and that is the continual process of scientific research. It is a process. I pin my loyalty to one particular model of the origin of life that is currently being worked on and being experimented with. It may yet turn out to be another dead end. It may be incorrect. We may have better or different scientific models that may be like the primordial soup that Fuzz was mentioning earlier. We don't know. At the moment, it is my argument that the strongest scientific evidence points to this particular naturalistic, the hydrothermal vents that I've mentioned already, but also that the other stages that we know life participates in, including DNA and RNA and lipids and all metabolism, many of the aspects of those are also being answered by scientific research.
Okay, Fuzz, I feel free, guys, to sort of, you know, speak to each other at this point, but be interested in your response to that. Am I correct in saying that design is an option on the table for you when it comes to the origin of life? You don't see that as outside the realm of a scientific hypothesis of how life came to be?
Well, that's a great question. And the way in which science is currently operates is essentially adhering to a set of principles known as methodological naturalism. And the idea, of course, is that in science you can only entertain explanations that essentially involve some kind of mechanistic explanation. And, of course, in the evoking a supernatural agent or an intelligent designer is, again, out of the bounds of science. So I fully understand that this is the way in which contemporary science operates. And so I do believe that it is possible, however, to evoke the work of a designer or a creator, whatever you want to refer to, the intelligent agent, and incorporate it into the realm of science. Because, you know, science, for example, does have the capability of detecting the involvement of intelligent agencies. Just a very quick example would be SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And that whole program is predicated on the ability of scientists to discriminate some kind of astronomical signal that's from a naturalistic source, discriminated from a source that emanates from an intelligent civilization. So within the toolkit of science is this capacity to detect the activity of intelligent agency. It's just that this philosophical framework and essentially prohibits an appeal to a supernatural agency. And so if you relax that requirement, I think it is possible to put a design hypothesis onto the table. And I do believe that the dead ends that I'm speaking about are actually pointing us to the work of a mind that, again, is necessary in accounting for the origin of life. Now, I'm not going to argue a God of the gaps. That is, I do not think that is a valid way to argue. That is, because we currently don't have an explanation for the origin of life through chemical evolution, therefore there must be a creator. I reject that line of argumentation. Rather, I think we need to present, you know, positive reasons why we think The failure of chemical evolution actually is suggesting the work of a mind. And one thing that I think is rather intriguing, and that is the fact that when you look at, again, this whole idea of translating the work in the laboratory to the conditions of the early Earth, what's interesting is that by and large, the chemistry that is possible in the laboratory is possible because you have organic chemists or biochemists who are intelligent agents who are rigging the experiment in such a way that the chemistry works. And of course, those intelligent agents are not present under the conditions of the early Earth from a chemical evolutionary perspective. And that, I think, explains the problem in translating the chemistry from the lab to the conditions of the early Earth. And I would argue that this is actually suggestive of, again, a work of a mind in bringing life into existence, because we know empirically that in the laboratory, intelligent agents are necessary to make the experiment work.
Let's just quickly, before we have to go to our first break, hear a response there from Adam. Why? Okay, it is an option. Let's relax this methodological naturalism, to use the long word that Fuzz uses there. Why for you doesn't that work?
Well, because it, as I mentioned earlier, it raises more questions than answers. I applaud Fuzz's attempt to avoid the whole concept of the God of the Gaps, which is a fallacious argument in general, and is simply eroded by the process of science. So it's what we don't know, we insert God. And of course, science only progresses in one direction, so it's that idea is perpetually being eroded. So I do applaud that. However, I am in slightly intrigued as to which stage of any of the processes, and I realise we're in danger of getting bogged down into some pretty biochemical details quite quickly when I ask this question, but at what stage Fuzz would suggest that those dead ends invoke the hallmarks of design rather than a naturalistic option?
So the question is, why at what point do we stop looking for a naturalistic explanation and sort of say, no, we have to now turn to a design explanation?
Because that still sounds a little bit like a God of the Gaps type argument to me, in that a piece of research results in a dead end and we fail to get to the answer. So is it at that point that the hand of God is introduced, or the hand of a design agency, whatever you want to call it?
Because it still sounds like God of the Gaps. Well, we won't get much of an answer if I allow Fuzz to answer now, because we're just about to go to a break. So hold your thought there, Fuzz, and we'll come back to you as we start to unravel some of this stuff. And yes, we will probably get to some fairly in-depth biochemical stuff, but I know you can handle that. If you're a listener to Unbelievable, you're used to some in-depth discussions. So do join us on the other side of a quick break. We're looking today particularly at Adam Rutherford's new book, Creation, The Origin of Life, one of a twin set of books, the other, Creation, The Future of Life. And we're going to be talking about that on next week's program again, with Fuzz Rana joining us from the States. So come back though in a moment's time. We're talking, how did life begin, today on the program that aims to get you thinking. Was it designed? That's the contention of Fuzz Rana. Can we go to a naturalistic explanation? Is that the direction we should always be seeking in science? That's certainly the view of Adam Rutherford, and we'll be back in just a moment's time.
Do the Bible and science really contradict each other? Is there really a historical Adam and Eve? These are only a few of the questions that seem to indicate an apparent conflict between science and faith, and this is why Reasons to Believe exists. RTB's mission is to demonstrate that sound reason and scientific research consistently support, rather than erode, confidence in the truth of the Bible. Our work shows how the record of nature and the record of Scripture reveal the God of the Bible as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Find out how you also can give a skeptical world reasons to believe. Visit us today at reasons.org.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And back to our conversation in a moment's time between Adam Rutherford and Fuzz Rana on the origins of life. Just a quick reminder before we get back into today's conversation that I'd love to see you, if you can make it, at Unbelievable the Conference 2013. This year in partnership with Reasons to Believe, Real Clear Apologetics and RE Today Services. Our conference theme this year, Jesus, Liar, Lunatic, Legend or Lord. We're going to be taking a long, hard look at what the evidence is for the person of Jesus, the claims he made about himself, and how we can share that with a very sceptical world today. Some expert speakers are going to be joining us to take that on, including Alistair McGrath, Amy Orr Ewing from the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, Peter S. Williams, who we had on with AC Grayling recently, and we'll hear some of the feedback to that show later on in today's programme. And there's all kinds of other seminars going on as well. Faith on the front line. Science, is it on the side of Christianity? And my guest today, Fuzz Rana, is going to be presenting on that. So if you want to hear more from Fuzz, and indeed on all kinds of other topics, then do come along to this year's conference. Book your place at premier.org.uk/Jesus. That's the website address to go to. If you book two or more tickets, you'll get last year's conference on DVD for free as well. Can't say fairer than that, can we? So do come along. We'd love to see you there. That's on Saturday, the 25th of May in central London. It's at a conference venue called The Brewery in Chiswell Street. And all the details found, as I mentioned, on the website, premier.org.uk/Jesus. Let's get back into today's discussion. Well, coming back to you, Fuzz, in that last section, Adam was suggesting that you talk about dead ends. Well, the design option is itself a dead end, because for him it always boils down to some kind of God of the gaps theory, i.e. we insert God into the gaps that science hasn't explained. As those gaps are explained, God sort of gets squeezed out as an explanation. It's never been a satisfactory explanation, says Adam. Why should it be now? You seem to be suggesting, when you were speaking on this before, that you don't agree with this God of the gaps idea, that somehow there is a positive case to be made for design. So I think that's what Adam's hoping to hear from you, why it isn't just a case of saying, we haven't explained it by your method, it must be God. What's the positive case you're making then for the origin of life being designed?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I want to be clear that I'm not saying that a design hypothesis should supplant all the work that's being done in chemical evolution, but rather it ought to be an option that's on the table alongside other, you know, for lack of a better term, naturalistic explanations, if you will. So I would like to see the possibility of it at least being on the table and up for discussion. And again, I would actually adhere to a version of methodological naturalism that I'll call soft methodological naturalism. That is, that when we study nature, we should look for naturalistic explanations first. But when we begin to apparently exhaust all the possibilities, I think at that point we should at least be open to entertaining, again, the work of a creator. But it's got to be done in a framework that, again, promotes scientific advance. And, you know, I would again point out that what's provocative is, number one, that when, again, you try to translate the chemistry from the laboratory to the conditions of the early Earth, it looks as if that translation process requires an intelligent agent. And let me very, very quickly talk about experiments that I think are incredibly important experiments about RNA assembly on clay surfaces. I can remember in the mid-90s when Leslie Orgel and James Ferris were doing experiments showing that you can assemble, you know, clay on clay surfaces, RNA molecules that were about 50, you know, subunits in length. And this is a rather large piece of RNA that would assemble, oh, you know, over the span of about 2 weeks in their experimental setup. But as you begin to peel back the layers, because on the surface, this looks like, wow, this process could happen on the early Earth. RNA could assemble on clay surfaces. Why do you need a creator to explain this? Well, when you peel back the surface and look at the experiment, number one, you note that the clays that are used have to be from a particular source. They have to be treated in a particular way to remove all the counter ions except for sodium. That you are using activated nucleotides as starting materials, not the types of materials that likely would exist on the early Earth. And you're very careful to exclude any kind of materials that would interfere with the RNA assembly that would likely be present on the early Earth. And then you have to stop the reaction at just a particular point in time, because once the RNA molecules get too long, they irreversibly adsorb on the surface of the clay. And so the point being is that these researchers used activated chemicals, chemically activated ribonucleotide subunits. They used specially treated clay from a special source, and they stopped the reaction at the right time and were very careful to avoid chemical interference. And so, yes, the reaction works because you have intelligent agents making it possible. And literally, you can go through every prebiotic experiment that's been done and identify problems like the ones that I'm pointing out. And so this to me is pointing to the necessity of an intelligent agent. Now, it doesn't prove it, but it suggests that maybe this might be something that one could plausibly entertain as again, a scientific model. And I don't see this as being necessarily a showstopper for science. It's just going to open up another set of questions that are just as intriguing from a scientific perspective, I would contend.
Okay, very interesting. So these experiments, they obviously have to be designed. Experiments in that sense are designed. They have to be carefully monitored. There has to be all these particular conditions laid down. So they're not really replicating what was happening in the prebiotic soup or whatever of the Earth, says Fuzz.
To a certain extent, yes and no, but some of the experiments in this area, some of the work of John Sutherland, also Nick Lane at UCL, are trying to emulate a much more experimental environments the experiments are much less designed than you might have, many of the experiments that Fuzz is describing. So there is definitely a movement away from these very clean, lab-based designed experiments that he's talking to. So I do take his point very well there. It's a very well-made point. There is, however, the other argument that defends my stance, which is that we've been doing this for about 50 years. And so you might have all of the glassware and all of the chemicals from a chemical company on your shelf and designed in order to ask a specific question about how a complex biological molecule might have emerged from simpler non-biological molecules. The Earth had about 4.5 billion years. And so the number of times those types of experiments could have happened on the very early Earth, so we'll just call it half a billion years, to give it some limitations. That means that those type of reactions will have had literally hundreds and hundreds of trillions of times for them to happen. And it only has to have happened once successfully in order for that first, for example, informational molecule such as RNA to start self-replicating. Now, that's one aspect of life that is part of the origin of life, the science of the origin of life. So, for example, looking for the first replicating molecules, the first molecules capable of storing information. There's experiments that have been done in very clean test tubes and in heavily designed experiments in San Diego, a group led by a chap called Jerry Joyce, that I'm sure Fuzz will know his work very well. They have designed a situation in which they start off with a range of molecules which are effectively random, or semi-random, in fact. But there are literally billions of versions of these molecules, and you get a form of selection emerging from this pool. If they get the conditions right, you begin to see that one molecule out of literally trillions begins to replicate on its own.
Do you think then that the origin of life was in some sense inevitable? Given the right conditions, you would get eventually a self-replicating molecule?
It's a very tricky question to answer that, because the answer is yes, but we only have a sample size of one. So looking for Fuzz mentioned the SETI, which is, of course, you know, a really decent scientific project, and it would be lovely to find extraterrestrial life, or life even on Earth that wasn't based on the tree of life that we know, because it would show that the inevitability had automatically doubled. Going from a sample size of one to a sample size of two would make my argument much, much stronger. Although I'm sure that Fuzz would make the same claim from his perspective.
Well, I'd just be interested in hearing, Fuzz, what for you, this talk of the number of times that nature had the opportunity to run the experiment over half a billion years or whatever in those conditions, does that for you, you know, help with the odds, you know, because people talk about the staggering odds against the first DNA replicating a molecule just coming together by chance? It just doesn't seem possible, you know, chance just doesn't seem an option on the table. But if you've got the conditions running for a long time, you've got this particular type of model that Adam's putting forward in the book, does that kind of, you know, help with against those odds? Does it start to, you know, suggest that the design hypothesis isn't the only one that we should be looking at?
Right. You know, now one thing I'm going to say, which for people who are from a Christian perspective are going to find a little bit troubling, but I actually am uncomfortable with the idea of referring to the origin of life from a scientific perspective as something that essentially is a chance outcome, that life is so complex that the probability of life assembling on its own is so remote that even 500 million years is not enough time. Because in a sense, that really represents a straw man depiction of what origin of life researchers are claiming. They're not claiming that life emerges through chance. They're claiming that life emerges through chemical selection. And so when an origin of life researcher says, is life's origin chance or necessity, they're actually talking about something very different. Is the origin of life just something that happens very rarely, or is it inevitable when chemical evolution and chemical selection are in play? And so that really is the debate that's going on. It's the same mechanism, but it's not a mechanism driven by chance. So, you know, I'm not real comfortable saying that 500 million years is enough time or not enough time, because I think that really is a misrepresentation of what original life researchers are saying. Now, one thing that's rather interesting is it looks as if from the geochemical record that life appears on Earth arguably at about 3.8 billion years ago. And this very well could be the first instance in Earth's history where life could conceivably originate, let alone persist. Because prior to that time, the Earth is experiencing tremendous impact events that are rendering the surface and in some instances the subsurface of the planet into a molten state. Water on the surface of the Earth would exist in the form of vapor and steam. It's an incredibly harsh, hostile environment. And even as the Earth is beginning to exit this Hadean era, there's an event called the Late Heavy Bombardment that happens at about the same time that life appears on the surface of the planet. And so these would be pretty significant frustration events for the origin of life. And so I would actually argue that the window of time for the origin of life is far less than 500 million years, maybe on the order of 10 million to maybe at the outmost 100 million years. Now, is that enough time for life to originate or not? I don't know. My suspicion is that that is a pretty rapid origin of life if left to simply chemical evolution. But again, there's no way to really rigorously make a case that 10 million years is insufficient for the origin of life, but I've yet to see anybody demonstrate scientifically that that window of time is sufficient either for the origin of life. It's simply, I think, really an assumption.
You were shaking your head there, Adam. So
I was gently shaking my head because, again, I don't think we could get stuck down in some scientific debate quite quickly. But there is plenty of evidence that there was a lot of water on the Earth from very soon after it was formed, about 4.54 billion years ago. Fuzz is absolutely right in saying that the Hadean, which is the first era of the Earth, was a hostile environment, but it might not have been quite as hostile as we originally thought. We do know that there was plenty of water there. There have been a number of studies which have indicated, these are calculations and models, which have indicated that although this period of intense meteoric bombardment from the heavens, which lasted 300 million years, called the Late Heavy Bombardment, was enough to sterilize the Earth, there have been some suggestions by other scientists that they probably wouldn't have sterilized at the bottom of the oceans. So, again, this is an area where we don't know the answer, but there is plenty of healthy scientific debate about what this era, which is sometimes known as the cryptic era because it's difficult to find things out about it, but it's all robust scientific debate that doesn't require the agency of design. Now, I know Fuzz has already pointed out that, you know, he would like the debate to actually include that as a possibility. I just don't see the need for it, because as we make progress in science by looking at robust evidence and we have healthy debates and we come up with the best fit. And so the experiments that are going on at the moment that are trying to address various aspects of where life, where the hallmarks of life might have emerged in a naturalistic way, what we're doing is we're looking for signs. We're not looking, we're quite a long way from recreating or emulating the origin of life itself, you know, creating a cell from its component parts. That isn't going to happen for many, many years. But the experiments going on in various aspects of biology, origin of life biology, are looking for signs, looking for the spontaneous emergence of the chemicals, the biochemistry that we see in every living cell. And at no stage in the process, even though these sometimes reach dead ends or sometimes fail as experiments, at no stage in the process do I see that these are not questions which are answerable by looking at basic chemistry and the transition from chemistry to biochemistry without the need for a hand.
Okay, so Fuzz, just we're coming back to this central question of whether design should even be on the table, and for Adam, it just seems as though you're introducing an unnecessary element. We've got by fine without design up till now. Why shouldn't we keep going in the assumption that there will be a naturalistic explanation, even if we run into dead ends along the way?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there was just a paper published recently, I believe, in the in a journal called the Journal of the Royal Society Interface, by Paul Davies, an astrobiologist and physicist, and Sarah Walker, an astrobiologist, who basically have argued that, again, we're looking at dead ends everywhere we look when it comes to origin of life explanations. And they basically are suggesting that the real issue is accounting for the origin of algorithmic information. And this is, of course, information that is embedded within matter that then tells the matter how to behave, how to operate. And so they're arguing, again, that this is really the central question, but yet this is very different type of information than the syntactic information you would see in an RNA molecule or some kind of self-replicating entity. They're arguing that this is really a set of instructions that matter itself is harboring that dictates how that matter operates. And their closest analogy would be the von Neumann automaton.
You'll have to explain what that is, because I've never heard of it.
It's basically a machine that, in effect, can produce other machines, including itself, and that there is a master switch that toggles back and forth between using those instructions to operate the machine and using those instructions to build itself. And so this is what they're arguing is the analogy now for what life is, and that this is really what we need to target when we try to explain the origin of life. Now, Adam would say that this represents advance in terms of, you know, again, probing the origin of life question, and I would fully agree with it. But what, again, I find intriguing here is that what Davies and Walker are doing is introducing an analogy for life that is essentially an abstract machine that represents the construct of a human mind. And so, again, this is very much dancing around an idea of a design hypothesis. Now, I've read Davies on the origin of life, and he's very much committed to pursuing a naturalistic explanation. Again, but he would in effect agree with my assessment that the dead ends are real dead ends, and that this really requires a completely novel approach to the origin of life. And he's suggesting trying to frame the questions in terms of how do we understand the origin of algorithmic information, which is very different than the types of experiments that Jerry Joyce is doing, which are excellent experiments, by the way. I have great admiration for the work that his lab has been doing over the last probably 20 plus years in this arena. So please don't, you know, take, you know, my skepticism as being critical of the work or the work of his work or the work of origin of life researchers.
Yeah. Adam?
I don't know the paper you're referring to with regards to Paul Davies, I would be loath to slander him, but he is working well outside his field when he's talking about that, and has a track record of talking well outside his field on matters in which his expertise is questionable. But again, I find it unnecessary. So if we try to reduce what the most basic processes of biology are, they are the ability to harness energy from the environment, right? That is what all cells do. They also do a bunch of other stuff, including replicating information and transferring that over generational time and all sorts of other behaviours. But the most fundamental thing that cells do is to continue to harness energy from the environment. Now, when we begin to see the processes that emulate the type of biochemistry that harnessing of energy does, if we can see that experimentally or in the natural world in places like the hydrothermal vents in the Lost City and in the mid-Atlantic, then again we require no further explanation. We require no further explanation other than that these are events that occur in the natural world, and that it is the concatenation of all of those things, the stacking of all of those types of natural processes that we do see both experimentally and in the natural world, that where you get a robust theory of the origin of life. Now, again, I do think that, you know, Fuzz is absolutely right that with all the dead ends and with all the experimentation and all the problems of experimentation being too clean and the timescales and all of those things are basically right. However, I see our trajectory along this pathway of filling in those dead ends or going over, you know, getting round the obstacles until we get to a point where we do have a robust model.
Let me put the cat among the pigeons here for you, though, Adam. Is your belief that we will come to a natural explanation, in a sense, an article of faith for you as far as the nature of science? Why must it exclude a design hypothesis? Fuzz made the point earlier that we don't exclude that hypothesis in other areas of science. The SETI project, for instance, is looking for potentially intelligence by sorting out the kind of signals that would suggest a natural explanation or an intelligent one. Why in this instance can't you have that as the option? Is it because science doesn't do God, as far as you're concerned? And if that's so, is that a sort of a bias coming from a kind of an atheistic worldview?
Well, it doesn't necessarily need to be there.
It doesn't need to,
and so it's a slight category error argument to compare this to SETI, for example, because we see the agency of design all around us all of the time. Okay, so we are great designers, and we do the fact that we are talking to each other down microphones that have been designed by man. This is a very clear agency of design by human hands. Now, if we were to detect a signal that was from intelligent life using SETI, then that would also be in the same category as any of the technology that we see around us. That's not what we're talking about here. That's not what we're arguing about when it comes to the origin of life. We're talking about very, very specific biochemical reactions that occur in nature that we are testing using experiments in the lab, and that transition from chemistry to biochemistry. So the type of design, I'm intrigued. I don't know what the type of design that Fuzz is actually talking about might look like. At what stage in a biochemical reaction where you have one molecule attaching to another molecule which attaches to another one, which we can emulate in the lab, I don't see why we need or at what stage you'd see actually someone, yeah, or, you know, a supernatural entity coming in and saying,
you move here, you move there.
Yeah, so
line
for,
up like,
you know,
that.
So,
yeah,
for example, the letters of DNA, that we, again, the one I was referring to that I know Fuzz knows well about, there are two potential options for where you might see a molecule of uracil, which is one of the letters of the RNA, where you might see that bind to another one in order to create a chain, right? There are two options where that can happen. One results in an RNA molecule that is what we see in living things, and the other results in a biochemical dead end. Now, experimentally, you can try and get that process to happen, and you can stack the odds so that you get one rather than the other. Now, in nature, we don't know what the precise nature of the mix was when that happened the first time round 4 billion years ago, but we do know that it did happen.
And So the question I suppose, Fuzz, to you is, at what point do you invoke design? And what would that even look like as a scientist? You know, would, if you could go back to that chamber under the sea, let's say, where the first molecules came together in just the right order and so on, are you saying, Fuzz, that God did that, that as it were, you know, an invisible hand literally arranged the things in the right order? And is that a satisfactory explanation? Obviously, Adam's very suspect of that.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm very sympathetic to what Adam is saying. And again, this goes back to a point that I made earlier, if I may very briefly reiterate it. And that is, I believe that what origin of life researchers have successfully done is demonstrated that in principle there's nothing with regard to the origin of life process that defies the laws of chemistry or physics. But to use a word that Adam used, it's all the catenation of these different processes that we see in nature that essentially is what we need to figure out in order to explain the origin of life. And I believe that's the place where you see the work of a mind necessary. It's the catenation of all these processes. And the analogy that I would use would be an automobile engine. There's nothing about an automobile engine that defies the laws of chemistry or physics. In fact, you can look at different elements of the function of an automobile engine and see examples in nature where those chemical and physical processes are in play. But it's putting all of those processes together in a coherent manner to produce an automobile engine that I believe is where the design is introduced. And so I would argue that life is analogous, again, to an automobile engine in that sense, where it's the work of a designer is at that particular point in the process. Now, how do I think God or the intelligent designer, whatever intelligent agent, whatever term you'd like to use here, how do I think God did that? I don't know, but it does look to me as if what we're seeing here is a fingerprint for the work of an intelligent agent. And I think at that point, if the design hypothesis is on the table, we can begin to ask questions as to specifically how did God go about doing this. But I would argue that in a sense, maybe what we do as human beings is a good analogy, because from a Christian worldview perspective, the idea is that human beings are made in the image of God. And so what we do when we create and invent, I would argue, is mimicking the work of a creator. And so if chemists are in the lab getting the conditions and just right and essentially rigging the experiment for success, maybe that's what God did as well. But that's essentially just speculation, obviously, on my part.
We're going to have to go to another quick break, and we'll start to wrap things up in a moment. A fascinating discussion here on the program today. Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley. Adam Rutherford is our scientist who's saying that we don't need a design explanation for the origin of life. That's what his new book's about, Creation, the Origin of Life. On the other hand, Fuzz Rana from Reasons to Believe is saying it looks for all the world like there is a design going on here and it's not an option that's off the table. What do you think? I'd be interested in hearing from you. Do get in touch. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And towards the end of today's programme, as usual, we'll hear some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. We've done quite a few different subjects. But science, that's what we're looking at today, the origin of life, and we'll be back in just a moment's time.
Is science and religion incompatible? If you're a youth group leader and you want to start a discussion in a way that engages young minds, try Science and Belief, an exciting resource now available online. Simply gather your group together, download the leader's notes, watch one of 12 fascinating short videos on YouTube, and let the mind-expanding conversations begin. And there's an online questionnaire, as we'd love your feedback. Visit retoday.org.uk/scienceandbelief.
Welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show where Christians and non-Christians get together to talk, and sometimes it's Christians and Christians doing a discussion of one kind or another. If you're waiting and wondering why the Peter Kraft and Richard Norman episode, Christian and atheist philosopher coming on to discuss the argument from desire, where that went, it was supposed to air last week, then you'll be glad to know it will be coming, but because of circumstances beyond my control, essentially involving my two-year-old son swallowing something he shouldn't have swallowed and having to be rushed off to hospital. He's fine. He's absolutely fine now. But it meant that the recording had to be postponed. So we will be doing that at another time in the near future, we hope. In the meantime, if you're listening via the radio today, then the next discussion you'll hear next Saturday is actually going to be with well-known Christian pastor, author, video maker, soon-to-be TV personality Rob Bell, who's, well, used to creating a bit of controversy in the evangelical Christian world. I had him on my show 2 years ago to talk about his book Love Wins. Well, he's back with a new book, and he's been doing a lot of things in the last 2 years. So we're going to be asking essentially, where is Rob Bell at? And I'm going to be joined by Andrew Wilson, who's a young Christian apologist and theologian from the New Frontiers Network here in the UK. And we're going to be sitting down to have a good old chat with Rob Bell. So I hope you can join me for that if you're listening in next week. For those who are listening to this via podcast, the next show you'll actually get in your podcast feed, in your stream, will actually be part two of today's programme as we ask the question, what about synthetic biology, creating life in the lab? And I'm going to be joined by Fuzz Rana again and Adam Rutherford for that. If you're listening via radio, you'll have to go to the podcast to get that one. That's going to be a podcast special as we sort of do a part two to today's discussion. That's what's to come on the programme. Lots of interesting stuff as ever here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Unbelievable. Don't forget also, I'd love to see you at Unbelievable, the conference 2013. If you haven't heard about it, where have you been living? Under a rock somewhere? Why not tell your church about it too? Perhaps send the message on to someone you know who'd be interested in finding out how to defend your faith with the best in intellectual arguments, how to really get hold of some of those issues around Jesus and the Bible, science, philosophy, what do we do about suffering? All of that kind of stuff is going to be covered, including some ethical questions around abortion and so on, and a host of fantastic speakers. So if you want to get involved, if you want to turn up on Saturday the 25th of May, do book your tickets now. premier.org.uk/Jesus. And there's a good, nice little video you can watch that'll introduce you to some of the speakers and topics going on at the webpage there. So do book in premier.org.uk/Jesus. Time to finish up with today's discussion on the show today on the origin of life.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So as we finish our conversation on the origin of life, we've been asking, how did life begin? And it's one of the big puzzles that has been at the forefront of biomolecular chemistry over the last few decades. Life is incredibly complex and at its outset had some pretty remarkable features that allows it to produce, reproduce and so on. And it's a puzzle that people like Adam, people like Fuzz, who are my guests on the program today, have been looking into. Adam prefers, in fact, says we really have to go for a natural explanation. We can't invoke design. As much as it looks nice, as much as, you know, we tend to do that with other things around us, in this instance, we're looking for a naturalistic explanation. That's the way science works. Fuzz, on the other hand, from Reasons to Believe, who's with us from the States, says he doesn't see why design can't be used. When you've exhausted all the dead ends of natural explanation, we have to ask ourselves, could there be a supernatural explanation, an agent, some kind of other way in which life arose? I think you've been enjoying the conversation as much as you disagree strongly with Fuzz's take on things. I mean, do you see this as a valid conversation in the first place? I mean, lots of people would say this just, you know, intelligent design, let's face it, has got a pretty bad rap in a lot of the scientific community, Adam. And from that point of view, it's seen as almost toxic as a sort of, you know, poisoning of the well of science by even introducing this whole thing. But you seem to have been engaging yourself personally in a productive way. So do you think there is a conversation at least to be had here?
Oh, I certainly am enjoying myself. And it's always nice to talk to someone who knows the subject, which is often not the case when we have arguments about between science and people of faith. So that aspect of it is great fun. However, I think that Fuzz has just undermined his argument by using the analogy of the motor car. And in fact, it's that what that says to me very clearly is that there isn't a fundamental difference between his argument about the intricacies of very complex biochemistry that was happening on the Earth 4 billion years ago and what he sees as the fingerprint of design. That now sounds not fundamentally different from any of the other creationist arguments, which are either biblically literal, that all animals, all creatures were created at some point 6,000 years ago, or the intelligent design community's arguments about seeing the fingerprints in living things that we see, in DNA. It just says the same argument to me, which is that these things are inscrutably complex, and therefore we invoke the fingerprint of design. So even though, yes, I have definitely enjoyed it, it's always enjoyable talking about pretty complex matters with experts, I don't see a fundamental difference between the types of creationism that we have come to, that we tend to avoid, both me and you, and on this program, and a much more, what seems like a much more sophisticated biochemistry-based argument, but actually says the same thing.
You're saying eventually it boils down to essentially the same thing, which is it's too complicated, God did it sort of thing. I mean, that, I don't know if you've seen this, Fuzz. There's a popular cartoon going around the internet, which is a large blackboard full of physical equations, but one break in the process, and it written in is a miracle occurred, and then it carries on, and it's something like one professor saying to the other, I think I've spotted a problem in your equation. I mean, is that what it boils down to? Because I think this is Adam's worry, Fuzz, that you're invoking something which essentially goes beyond the realm of science, you know, when you start to say, yeah, we've got to a point where we have to invoke some kind of divine agency in order for our science to work at this point.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I very much appreciate and sympathetic with Adam's concern and the concern of many people in the scientific community along these lines. And I think that if we're going to genuinely have a design hypothesis on the table, it has to operate within the framework of science. That is, it has to produce predictions that are testable and that actually can guide and direct and suggest future direction for research within the scientific arena. I believe it's actually possible to do that. I am again sympathetic to the idea that maybe what I'm arguing for here sounds like kind of, you know, run-of-the-mill creationism, because I do believe that in order to explain the origin of life, you have to evoke the work of a mind. But, you know, I've tried to present in my mind positive evidence towards that, you know, towards that end. But, you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed this interaction. And, you know, I am somewhat embarrassed that Adam would say that it's very seldom that there's actually Christians who engage in these kind of conversations from a standpoint of knowledge. And I think it's very important that we do our homework and we really understand what's going on in the scientific arena, what the ideas are, that we don't create straw men. And I think if we do that, we might actually have a much more serious hearing on the part of the scientific community. We might be treated with much more respect and genuinely be engaged by the scientific community. So I'm very much sympathetic to that. And I think Adam and I do agree on this one point, and that is the origin of life question is extremely fascinating. The work that's been done from a scientific perspective in the arena of chemical evolution is incredible work. And it's in and of itself fascinating. There's so many intriguing questions that arise. This is something that's well worth everybody taking the time, regardless of your worldview, to learn about.
Thank you very much for being with me on the program today, Fuzz. And, well, we look forward to hearing from you again, because Fuzz and Adam are coming back. Now, if you're listening to this on the radio on Saturday afternoon, you'll have to go online to listen to part two, because that's going to be a podcast special. We're going to be coming back to talk about the future of life. Creating Life in the Lab is the name of Fazrana's most recent book. And indeed, a not dissimilar title, Creation, the Future of Life, is the flip side, if you like, of Adam Rutherford's most recent book. And so we're looking forward to that discussion, gentlemen. And Adam, well, we'll be back to discuss that next time here on the programme. For the moment, thank you very much for joining me today. And I'm glad you've enjoyed the conversation. I'm sure for many people, this will be the start of looking into an area which has hitherto been a bit of a mystery. We've had a fairly high level discussion today. What kind of readership is your book aimed at? Do you have to be a scientist to be able to read your book?
I definitely hope not. this is a pretty chewy topic, as you know, we're just touching on it in this discussion between two people who you know, at least one of which knows the subject inside out. I'm not even going to say which one that was. But I hope that my book is accessible to anyone who is curious. It's I've gone to great lengths to leave a lot of stuff out, and that is that I think when you're talking to a public as an expert, that's a skill that one needs to learn. But yes, I hope that anyone can read it.
Okay. Creation, the Future of Life, and its twin book, Creation, the Origin of Life, which is what we've been talking about today, both available, and links, of course, from the podcast of today's programme. And indeed, I'll put links up, of course, to Fuzz, and where you can find out more about resources from Reasons to Believe and Fuzz's books. So if you're a podcast listener, do come back again for the next instalment of today's programme. For the meantime, thank you both, gentlemen, for being on the programme with me today. And coming up next, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. This is the program that aims to get you thinking unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you'd like to get in touch about anything you've heard on today's program, as ever, you can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I'd love to hear from you. And if you want to get in touch, of course, via the Twitter account, via the Facebook page, that's all there as well, @UnbelievableJB, to follow me on Twitter and to send me a message. You can also follow the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. Look forward to hearing from you. And a few people who've been in touch via email over the last week or two. I'm about to read some of those out. I should say, if you're interested and you want to look it up on YouTube or on the Unbelievable website, we've got a new video that's just come out. It's just a snippet of that debate between A.C. Grayling and Peter S. Williams. We did video it, and so we're putting together a few little pieces from it in a more bite-sized fashion. So you can see them on video in my studio debating the question of fine-tuning. Is God the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe? So search for that either on YouTube or follow the Facebook account, and you'll see it there on the Facebook page. Just another way of engaging with the show. You might want to share it on with other people who'd be interested. Thank you, Gabriel. I think that's the way I should pronounce your name. I think you're from the south of North America. You say, thanks for giving us such a great show to be familiar with faith and skepticism from across the pond. For the past 4 years or so, I've been paying attention to how folk deal with doubt in their life and doubt in the life of others. Some are healthy, but many are not. Here in the south of North America, on a popular level, it seems that people have a particularly difficult time using their words in almost every issue in faith, life, government, politics, and public life. Well, the poem below is a culmination of my time paying attention to doubt here in the south. I'm a sucker for a poem, so I thought I'd read this out, Gabriel. Here you go. I hope I do this justice. Doubt in the south. There's blinding invective and pain-throbbing tears. They've worn and torn coattails of parents and peers, just asking their questions, not knowing what for, and turned to in silence, words without warmth. There are questions galore, but no understanding, words without warmth. Blind are the eyes and ears do not hear, when questions are answered, words out of fear. There's a pendulum ride made from the years, from each generation of pain-throbbing tears, rejecting the worst of parents and peers, won't teach a heart patience, won't steady our fear. There's a teacher, a priest, who is what he says. He turned on convention and spurned the church heads. He gave to the Caesar the coin it was his, and gave to his father, whose image he is. Life-giving water flows from his mouth. He's doing and blessing. He's living it out. He is what he says and restores from his mouth. He's overcoming doubt in the South. Thank you very much, Gabriel. Thought-provoking stuff. Now, turning to the Easter edition of the show, we were talking about penal substitution as a view of the atonement of the cross. Defending that view was Steve Jeffries here on the programme. And he was in conversation with Alan Molyneux, who was defending the Christus Victor view. Not that Steve sees that as, in any way, not a good view of the cross, but certainly Alan Molyneux doesn't see penal substitutionary atonement as a correct view. And if you want to find out exactly what those terms mean, if you're not familiar with them, I do encourage you to go to the podcast and check out that programme that was aired over Easter, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, the usual place. Thanks to those who've been getting in touch, particularly a few people wanted to talk about Greg Boyd's contribution to that programme. He's a pastor and author out in America who, again, is a fierce critic of the penal substitutionary model of the atonement. Ben Trigg, for one, said, your show may be too short to air all the things that need to be said, but I think on this occasion I've heard enough to be able to process it all. Your show on penal substitution was very helpful. I wasn't sure where I stood on the issue, if I'm honest. I knew Christ died in my place, but I hadn't fully thought through the implications of what happens in that place. I've now been given the language to do so. It may be my bias against Calvinists, but for me, Steve Jeffries said a few too many things which he shouldn't be allowed to get away with. Firstly, having heard Greg Boyd's delightfully clear, well-thought-through comments on penal substitution versus Christus Victor, it was a surprise to hear that Jeffrey thought that the first half of his comments were a shamble, a confused mess, he called them, or something like that. Instead, Steve went on to the one thing that was not unique about what Greg said, but which was the general theme of the whole discussion, punishment. He went to the word propitiation, quoting 1 John 4:10, and defined it as turning away wrath. Well, when I looked up the word, no dictionary says that. They simply say that it has to do with atonement, at one meant, the process by which God and man are reconciled. No wrath necessary there. I'd like to hear him respond more fully to Greg's excellent observations. I realise the short amount of time in the studio precluded this a bit, but the time he did have and the response he gave was, I felt, a deflection. And you had more to say on your blog where you posted those comments, Ben, but thank you very much. Obviously, Ben feels that this for him was a decider on where he stood on the issue. Here's also Bruce Medeiros, who wants to say, having listened to the programme, I couldn't see the mess of confusion of what Greg Boyd said that Steve Jeffrey was suggesting. I found it very interesting that time and again Steve would say that this is what the Bible says, with the suggestion that this was his position, when the book that he co-authored, Pierced for Our Transgression, was considered by Tom Wright as being deeply unbiblical. I have a copy of Pierced for Our Transgressions, and I'm not impressed with the plethora of acknowledgement by well-known theologians who consider the book to be a remarkable book. It may be remarkable for reformers, but not for others. What I found even more unbelievable was that he suggested that propitiation was in the Bible. It's not in the Bible, but it's simply the translation of the Greek word hiasterion, used by Paul to describe Christ's reconciling work in his death. The reformist and fundamentalist's use of propitiation, whereas the more moderate and progressive evangelical theologians use expiation, which hasn't got a penal substitution bias that propitiation often has. So you again felt that the argument was against penal substitution. On the other hand, Paul McCauley takes a very different view in Belfast, says, I wanted to comment on the debate on the atonement. I was very disappointed with Greg Boyd's contribution. It seemed to me he could run a course on straw man making and well poisoning. Firstly, he initially spoke about penal substitution promoting redemptive violence. Now, violence is not usually used as a synonym for justice or punishment. Violence usually means an unjust or unwarranted exertion of force or power. And so the use of the word is an example of Greg assuming what he needs to prove, i.e. that the Lord bearing God's wrath in the place of sinners is unjust. God was not engaged in violence against his Son, but the Son willingly bore from the hand of God the just judgment due to sin. He said that penal substitution really promotes violence. That's almost slanderous. So secondly, you say disappointed at the complete unwillingness to fairly represent the penal substitution view on Greg Boyd's part. He claimed it portrayed God like a rageaholic who needs to vent his rage at someone. He says it presents a God motivated by wrath. It really couldn't be further from the truth. If God were motivated by wrath, he would never have given his beloved Son. He would have just let us take what was coming to us. And that brings me on to a third point. Greg asked, if sin demands an eternal punishment, then how is it that Jesus's short suffering on the cross makes atonement for that? But this is a question that's been answered loads of times by theologians for 2,000 years. Sin doesn't demand an eternal punishment, it demands an infinite punishment. And that's why Christ, who is God, could pay it and say it is finished. And it's why lost sinners will never be able to pay it and will never be able to say it is finished. And you've had a few more points there, but no time, I'm afraid, to bring all of them on this occasion. Thank you very much, Paul. Well, we're running out of time, so maybe just a quick mention of a couple of your responses to the A.C. Grayling and Peter S. Williams debate. They debated about three arguments for God on the back of A.C. Grayling's new book, The God Argument. As I mentioned earlier, you can see at least some edited highlights of one of their discussions on the fine-tuning of the universe. If you go onto YouTube, type in A.C. Grayling, Peter S. Williams, Unbelievable, you should find it. I've added it to the Unbelievable Facebook page and that kind of thing. So check that out if you want to see what it looked like when they were in the studio with me. Here's Carolyn, who says, what a pity you didn't ask A.C. Grayling if he'd be prepared to do the same with religious and secular views of life as he's asked people of faith to do. I want to pass on my belief system just as he wants to pass on his. Why is it okay for him to do so without giving the faith option, while I must always give the secular option? I speak about the Christian faith as truth, as that's what I believe to be the truth, and I don't think A.C. Grayling has the truth. You only discuss the content of his book, not his presuppositions. However, you did intervene later to ask him to justify his assertions. Enjoy the programme. Thank you very much, Carolyn. Glad you got something out of it. Derek is an atheist and says, well done, Justin, for getting A.C. Grayling on the programme. I'm quite a fan of his. However, I didn't fully agree with his use of objective for moral principles once he had outlined where they arise from. More generally, I still have a great deal of confusion with the idea of objective moral value. Starting the discussion, as Peter S. Williams did, with the very extreme case of torturing young children for fun is wrong, seems to muddy the waters. I suspect that everyone you ask will agree with that statement, and I can think of a number of reasons why that might be. Does this consensus mean that it is objective? I suspect not. Starting from a grey area like it is justified to use primates in experiments would be much more fertile ground. Where does the objectivity in that come from? Who decides what the objective truth is? Well, I suppose the point Peter S. Williams is making is if you can land on any statement which everybody, it appears, should agree with, then can we intuitively perhaps suggest that that is objectively true, if it seems to you that everyone should agree on that statement and anyone who doesn't agree on that statement is actually wrong about it? I think that's the point. And so obviously using a very clear example like torturing babies for fun is objectively morally wrong is helps to kind of clarify this is what we're talking about when we're talking about something objectively wrong. Anyway, much more that could be said. Thank you for your emails, and sorry that I haven't got to many of the other emails that have come in on the back of that programme. Thank you for listening today, and I do hope you can join me. Only about, 6 weeks to go until Unbelievable, the conference on Saturday the 25th of May. Do hope you can be there. Would love to see you there. Perhaps bring a friend and make the use of the DVD that you'll receive if you book two or more tickets. Would be great to see you there. We're really looking forward to what promises to be the biggest and best conference yet that we've run on apologetics and evangelism. Saturday, 25th of May, book in at premier.org.uk/Jesus. Let me tell you what's coming up next time.
You're unbelievable.
As I mentioned, if you can be on the podcast, you'll hear part two of today's program as we look at creating life in the lab and the kinds of questions that brings up as Fuzz Rana and Adam Rutherford join me again. If, though, you're listening via radio, next week's programme is actually going to be a conversation with Rob Bell, controversial US megachurch pastor, or he was until he stepped down from that position, now doing new things over in Hollywood. We'll be finding out what exactly, and about his new book, What We Talk About When We Talk About God. We'll be asking where his journey's taken him, and why so many evangelicals are worried about the direction his theology has taken in recent years. I'll be joined by Andrew Wilson of the New Frontiers Church Network for that discussion. Same time next week. Hope you can be with me then. Until then, have a great time.